In the weeks leading up to the spring holy days, I planned on revisiting some fundamental duties and responsibilities, I often call them, that we have as part of the ecclesia of God, the ecclesia, the called out ones, called out of this world into a relationship with God for a very specific purpose. As we near the Passover, we'll be reminded, either by myself or some of the other men speaking, of the responsibility to examine ourselves. We'll hear a message on considering if there's anything between you and a brother, or if there's anything between you and God that you know of that needs to be resolved. And we'll be reminded of the passage in Matthew 5 that says that to leave our gift at the altar and first be reconciled with one another. All principles, duties, responsibilities that we have. But before we delve into those topics, I thought it would be good to take a step back and just think about and be reminded why we're here. You know, it's a term we often hear at the feast. Somebody, you know, I've had multiple, I think the last 4 or 5 years, I've had the opening night message or the first holy day message, and we usually ask that question. It's kind of tradition. We often do that because people are traveling all over. But it's quite applicable to us today. And I'm not merely speaking about physically. We drove from wherever, and we all showed up here at this spot, gathering here in one location. But what do we hope to achieve by being here? Why are you here? What do you hope to achieve every Sabbath and holy days as they come around by being at them? Why do we observe food laws? Why do we leave in our homes before Passover? Why do we do the things that we do? We could be doing all these things, but why we are doing them says a lot to God. And we could be doing these things, but to what end? What is the goal? What is the result that we hope to achieve? What are we doing it for? Because in all of this doing, in all of this activity, do we know what we're trying to achieve? Because we could just keep doing this. I came in, I was 10 years old. I'll be 62 this year. That's a long time of just doing these things and repeating these things year after year. And repetition is good. I'll get to that in a moment. But we could be doing all these things. But why are we doing them? What are we trying to achieve by doing them? How do we measure progress to that end? I mean, what is the end? What is the goal? And how do we measure progress towards that? How do we know if we're accomplishing anything? Do we treat some of the things that we do as transactional? A quid pro quo. You know, this for that is what quid pro quo means. Something given in return for something else. Do we have the idea that if I do this, whatever this is, then God's obligated to do this? It's a quid pro quo. I do this and God does this. Is that our thinking? Because that's being very transactional. That's become like it's a business arrangement. And then what happens is when you have certain expectations, well, I did this, so God's supposed to bless me. And I did those things and God didn't bless me. Now you're upset because you had in your mind a preconceived transactional approach. You know, it's important for us to never forget what is truly happening in our lives. Again, it's why we're here. These things that we do are a means to an end, but they're not the end in and of itself. You know, God wants us to repeat every 7 days the Sabbath, right? As I said, some repetition is good. The things that God tells us to repeat, the Sabbath every 7 days, the holy days annually as they come around. He expects us to do those things and to prepare for them and be ready for them when they arrive, not just have them all of a sudden stumble upon us and we're not prepared. So God's not against the valuable lessons we learn from repetition. What he warns us against, we've looked at this recently, is vain repetition. You're doing the repetition, but you're just vainly empty, just going through the repetition without really thinking about what it is you're doing or why you're doing it. Join me in Matthew chapter 15. Jesus here is speaking to the scribes and Pharisees who were upset because Jesus didn't follow their, his disciples didn't follow their man-made traditions. He turns this back around on them in verse 3 and says, well, why do you transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition? So he turns their own accusation back on them. We drop down to verse 8 and notice what he says here. He's going to quote from the book of Isaiah. He says, these people, verse 8, they draw near to me with their mouth, honor me with their lips, but their heart, the seat of emotion, the deep inner purpose, why they do it, the heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching us doctrines, the commandments of men. Adam Clark's commentary says that they go on year after year, keeping your solemn feasts, yet know that God will punish you for hypocritical worship consisting of mere form destitute of true religious devotion, true reverence. You're just going through the motions, vain repetition. Right? So the repetition isn't wrong. We're actually commanded to do that. It's when we don't understand why and we're just going through it. So again, the point is we could be doing right things, if I could just call them things, all these things that we do. We could be doing right things and not understand what it is that it's supposed to lead to in our lives. Again, what is the end of the matter? Why are we here? And so in the time that I have today, I want to take a pause and step back and, you know, before we get into those messages of examining self and reconciliation, let's remember why we do the things that we do in the first place. Because when we understand why we do the things that we do, those other things become a whole lot easier. It makes a whole lot of sense why we do those things. I've titled the sermon, Why We Do the Things We Do. Notice 1 John chapter 3. Note here, beginning of verse 1, behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called children of God. Children of God. That's who we are. And so you should think about that when we come together, look around, we're all his kids. Right? He's called us from every walk of life, but he says to be children of God. Therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know him. Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Verse 3, and everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself. Here's part of the why. What are we trying to do? Why do we do what we do? Purifies himself just as he is pure. Verse 4, whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. You know, the Greek word translated here in verse 4 for sin is hamartia. You can do your own word study. It's 266 in the Greek in Strong's. It's a term that's used in archery for missing the mark. We've probably heard that term before, missing the mark. If you miss the mark, it's sin. And let me just say right here, we all miss the mark. In some aspect of our life, we all miss the mark. I once knew an individual who said to me, it's not in me to sin. I'm talking about a church member, not somebody. It's not in me to sin. Romans 3:23, to that point, let me just, again, look at that quickly. It's a familiar passage. All have sinned, right? Fall short of the glory of God. So it would be inappropriate, it would be wrong, it would be a lie for any of us to make that claim. Romans 3, 23 tells us, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We all miss the mark. All of us. Your repetition of those things that God asks us to do is an important aspect of our life. As I was exploring this concept of missing the mark, I read an article on what does it take to be an Olympic archer? Now, I've shot bow and arrow. Because I don't have enough time to practice, I transitioned to a crossbow. But to shoot a bow takes a lot of practice. But just how much practice does it take? So this article went on to say, if you want to be a good archer, and defined by someone who can put the arrow in the red-yellow all the time, you need to shoot 4 or 5 times a week, 80 to 100 arrows per day. It's a lot of arrows. If you want to be a great archer, someone who can put it in the yellow all the time, you need to shoot 100 to 120 arrows 5 times a week. If you want to be a champion archer, defined as someone who can put the arrow in the 10 most of the time, you need to shoot 5 times a week at least 120 arrows every time. And finally, it goes on to say, if you want to be an Olympic archer, 120 to 200 arrows per day, 6 days a week. I'm thinking that's pretty much all you do, right, is just shoot arrows. And I found it interesting because, you know, the article went on to say that there's many amazing things that happen when we shoot a lot of arrows. If you're training to be an archer, you get stronger, you develop muscle memory, you just do things without thinking because the body gets trained and disciplined to act in a certain way. And so as you build that muscle memory, some things get easier. You reach this, they call it a neurological point, where the brain just, it happens without thinking. You can just shoot. Never got there. I don't have that much time in my life to get to that point. So repetition is a good thing. And again, the admonition for us is it's the vain part of it. Not knowing why you're going through these things on a repetitive basis. You know, in Leviticus 23, we usually go there around the feast days. We talk about all the feasts of the Lord, and as is recorded there in the first few verses, the very first one mentioned is the Sabbath, Leviticus 23. Again, all these days, it says, are the feasts of the Lord. They're not our days. They're days that God has appointed for reasons that he has intended. They're appointments that he sets. We've covered this before. He calls us into his presence to come before him on the Sabbath. Verse 1, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh is the Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work on it. It is the Sabbath of the Lord in all your dwellings. And then it goes on to list all those feast days. We've looked at this before. The word for feast is moed, right? An assembly convened for a definite purpose. There's a specific purpose. And there's a reason God calls us together every 7 days. And it's not just because he commanded it, right? We should do what he commands us to do, but that shouldn't be the driving force, right? Verse 2 again, it says, these are God's feasts, right? And so as we've looked at this in the past, we come here, we gather before him, we come into his presence as he's called us to gather here on the Sabbath, right? But are we only keeping the Sabbath because God commands it? That's an individual question. Why are you here? Well, because God makes me do it, right? Let's just be blunt. I have to do it. Quid pro quo. God says I have to do this if I want to be in his kingdom, so I'm going to do that. If that's your motivation, you're missing the mark, right? You're missing the mark. You could still be here, but you're missing the mark. You're not understanding what God, why he wants us here. You know, John 14, 15, a familiar passage, right? If you love me, keep my commandments. So clearly we should do that, and that begins to entertain part of the why we're here. If you love me, keep my commandments. So are you doing this because you love God or you feel forced by God? What is your heart? What is your motivation? And so being here certainly is a submission to God's authority, right? We do what he commands us to do, but it should be an expression of our love towards God. You know, to be summoned into his presence should be a wonderful thing, to have the privilege. You know, as we've talked about this, I'm going off on a tangent at the council on this topic. You know, the idea of a king giving you a summons to come into his court, to come into his presence was a joy. You know, when you look back in history, it was an amazing privilege and we should view that as that opportunity to come into God's presence on the Sabbath. But it's not just God. I'm going to get ahead of myself as this has been on my mind for last week. But he wants us to appreciate and enjoy coming into his presence. And not simply because we're commanded to. Not out of ritual, not out of routine, just some vain repetition, but that we look forward to it. It's the high point of our week, that we can't wait to come into his presence and be with his people. Now, another reason for us to gather here is to learn to properly fear him. We've looked at this in the past, right? Again, I'm just trying to cover some background before we get into some things we need to discuss. And that word literally means to have awe and respect and revere and reverence, right? The privilege to come into God's presence. Not to tremble in fear, but what an honor, what a privilege that God would call us to be here on this day. Proverbs 1, verse 7 gives us an important thing to remember. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7, the fear, the awe, the reverence. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. The Kyle and Dillich commentary says the true meaning, therefore, is that Israel might rejoice with holy reverence in the fellowship of its God. I'm going to come to that word fellowship here in a moment. But that we would rejoice in holy reverence in the fellowship of God. It's not just showing up, as I've often say, and checking off a box that I, you know, got an A-plus in attendance this year. I was there every single Sabbath, didn't miss a Sabbath, right? In the Ecclesiastes, Solomon says, because again, this is beyond just keeping the Sabbath. He goes on to point out that, let me just read it. Ecclesiastes 12, right at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes. He speaks of the whole purpose of man, the whole purpose for our lives. Solomon boils it down to this, because he says, basically, the end of our physical life is vain, it's useless, it's a whisper, it's a vapor, it's gone before you know it. And he says here in Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13 and 14, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. This is the end of his writings here, the book of Ecclesiastes. Fear God, right? Have awe, reverence, respect for who and what he is, and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. I think if there's one aspect of life that is ignored is that very statement right there. There's a lot of secret things that go on in the lives of people today and even in the church. And God says, it'll all be revealed. It may not happen in this lifetime, but it'll be revealed sooner or later. But he says it's man's all. The whole duty, our whole duty, right, is to fear God, to revere him, to strive to become like him. As I'm starting to get a little bit ahead of myself, but so we should be planning each and every Sabbath to be here, to appear before God in fellowship with him, as Kyle and Dillich's commentary just said. And so it's clearly a responsibility that we have. It's part of his plan to bring many sons and daughters to glory, Hebrews 2:10. Right? This is part of that process and how he's going to do that. When you and I come to appreciate the meaning and purpose for the Sabbath and every holy day and why we're there, it is an expression of our love, not merely an obligatory response to a commandment. I have to do it, so I do it. And it's up to you to decide where you're truly at. Do you feel obliged, or is it truly something you love to do, to come into God's presence? But there's another aspect before we move on from the Sabbath and holy days themselves. And that is in Hebrews chapter 10. We've been there many times, but let's go there again. Hebrews 10:24 is the passage that we probably all have memorized. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. Hebrews 10:25. But I want to look at some other verses here in Hebrews 10 for context. Because again, we typically jump right to that, but the context here is speaking of our access to God the Father. You know, it says in verse 3 that under the Hebrews 10, verse 3, that under the old covenant, the actions of the priests really only served as a constant reminder of their sin. You know, you'd go there and you see priests are sacrificing, and it's basically a reminder, as it says, verse 3, those sacrifices there is a reminder of sins every year. But under the new covenant, we have access to Christ, or to the Father through Christ. And we have a much deeper relationship. So I want to begin in verse 19 of Hebrews chapter 10. It says, therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil that is his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart, not faithful obedience, you know, not, you know, checking the boxes, right? Because the obedience will come naturally if you have a true heart. In full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful, and let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. How can we provoke one another to love and good works if we never spend any time together? How are we going to do that? How do you truly motivate people, you know, if it's all over Zoom, right? All this technology we have is great when you've got nothing else, right? I'm tired of Zoom meetings. I'm just tired of them, right? They're just, you know, it seemed like a neat fad for a while. It was, wow, this is fun. After a while, we've all been on them, right? You're muted. You know how awkward they are. Somebody starts talking, and, well, I won't go there. If you spend any time on Zoom meetings, you know what I'm talking about. They're just painful, no matter how hard we try, right? The instruction here is that we would come together to provoke one another to love and good works. That's the why. It's why we come to. We come to hear messages, but there's more to it than that. And I'll get to that point here in a moment. You know, even I mentioned the little shorts that Mr. Shaby is doing. I don't know how one of them was touched on recently is, I don't know if you've noticed how many prominent like podcasters and internet personalities are speaking openly about the state of the world. As I mentioned, the announcement of Jesus Christ returning, and these are people that, you know, athletes that never ever used to talk about these things. They're just sitting around talking about, oh yeah, this is going to happen. The Bible says this, and Jesus Christ is about to return. And you're going, so they know. So much the more as you see the day approaching. They see the day approaching. And they don't even know what we know. But again, people are beginning to see the day approaching. We're going to come back to Hebrews in a moment here, but I want to go to Acts chapter 2. Notice the behavior of the first century church. Acts chapter 2, we're just going to look at one familiar verse. Verse 42. Acts chapter 2, verse 42. Well, I'll begin in verse 40. And with many other words, he testified and exhorted them, saying, be saved from this perverse generation. Then those who gladly received his word were baptized, and that day about 3,000 souls were added to them. Verse 42, and they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship in the breaking of bread and in prayers. Fellowship. The Greek word for most often translated fellowship in the New Testament is koinonia. Koinonia. The number, if you want to look it up, is 2842. It comes from a root word meaning a sharer, a partner, an associate. such that koinonia means a partnership that is literally participation. A partnership that is literally participation. You and I are in koinonia, or should be, all the time. Now, this is one of those things where we use fellowship as a word, and we usually talk about having fellowship before or after church. We're in fellowship the whole time. I'll get to that in a moment. We socialize before and after church, and it's okay that we call it fellowship. Don't get me wrong. But I want you to think about true fellowship, as we'll see in the scripture, is not something that happens before and after services. It's our relationship at all times. We should be in koinonia. We should be in fellowship. Thayer's lexicon says it means an association, community, joint participation, the share which one has in anything. And so fellowship, koinonia, is a close association involving mutual interests and sharing. It's a whole lot more than just showing up at the same time and same place at an event, such as Sabbath services. It's more personal than that. It's about behavior. It's about conduct. It's about interpersonal relationships and a relationship with God and Jesus Christ. Notice 1 John chapter 1. Fellowship, koinonia, is not merely a human plane relationship. 1 John chapter 1. In verse 1, it says, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled concerning the word of life. The life was manifested, and we have seen and bear witness and declare to you that eternal life which was with the Father and was manifested to us, that which we have seen and heard, we declare to you, that you also may have koinonia, fellowship with us. And truly our koinonia, our fellowship, is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. True fellowship is not just at this level. It's this, plus God and Christ. All of it. And so when we say we're going to have fellowship before and after church, you know, we're socializing. And it's okay. I'm not saying we got to start changing the words we use. But we need to expand our thinking and understand what fellowship is. It's us and God and Christ together. And these things we write to you that your joy may be full. This is the message which we have heard from him and declare to you that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. If we say that we have fellowship, koinonia, with him and walk in darkness, we lie. I do not practice the truth. You cannot walk in darkness and say, oh, I have fellowship with God. He says, that's a lie, because that's not the kind of relationship we're going to have with our Father and with Christ. But verse 7, if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship, koinonia, with one another, and the blood of Jesus Christ, his Son, cleanses us from all sin. And he goes on to say again, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. And so we begin to see what true fellowship is. It is a spiritual dimension, an emotional dimension, a relational dimension that happens between us and God and Christ, all of it together. And so it's important that we understand what it is that we're trying to achieve to have true koinonia, true fellowship. Go back now to Hebrews chapter 10. This is the uncomfortable part of Hebrews chapter 10. We'll begin in verse 26. Hebrews 10:26 says, for if we sin willfully after we have received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful expectation of judgment and fiery indignation which will devour the adversaries. Anyone who has rejected Moses' law dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. And verse 29, of how much worse punishment do you suppose will he be thought worthy who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, counted the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified a common or unholy, can be translated, thing, and insulted the Spirit of grace. You know, consider what he's saying to us here, right? To willfully neglect, to willfully not go to services. Now, as I say this again, we're not talking about the situations where somebody can't. We're not, hopefully we understand that. There's some that just, it could be health, it could be whatever. But to just decide, not today. Willfully neglecting, right? It's pretty strong words here. Paul goes on to say in verse 29, in essence, you know, do you have any idea what that punishment's going to be like? To willfully do that? You know, he just kind of leaves it there as a rhetorical question, right? And he ends there in verse 31. It's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And so our reason for being here has to be well beyond checking off the attendance box. I did my obligatory, I showed up at church. Right? It's got to be much, much deeper than that. Right? We have to get to a point where, you know, again, God knows the heart, right? So we have to love God so much that this is where we want to be on the Sabbath. Nowhere else. Don't want to be anywhere else. And of course, things happen and you can't make it. That's, God understands that. I mean, as I say, he knows who's playing games and who not. It's not up to me to care. I don't worry about it. God knows. He knows our heart, right? We have to show God we love him so much that this is where we want to be. We want to be in his presence and with his people on the Sabbath day to the extent I can. That should be our goal. And then, along with that, as you understand koinonia, we should have genuine love for one another. These are the people I want to be with on the Sabbath, every Sabbath, to the extent I'm able. I don't want to be anywhere else. I want to be in koinonia, fellowship with God the Father, Jesus Christ, and my brothers and sisters in the faith. That's where I want to be. That's my desire. And God knows if that's our desire or not. Right? We can fool ourselves, but he truly knows. And so we must appreciate that even right now as we sit here, well, you're sitting, I guess I'm standing, we're in koinonia. We are in fellowship with one another and the Father and Christ. It doesn't just happen before services or after services. It's all the time. It should be all the time, unless you're withdrawing from that, choosing not to be part of that. Otherwise, it should be very much a part of what we do. And finally, then, let's consider one aspect of why we do what we do, and that is to become like him, 1 Peter 1. Right? That truly is, like, why do we do the things that we do? We're trying to become like Christ, who set us an example in all things. We're trying to take on his nature in all things. That's what all of this is about. We don't just go to church to check off a box and say I was there and go home and drop the Bible down, put the notebook away, and wait till next Sabbath. No, it's about we go, we learn, we try to understand more, and we try to become like him. 1 Peter chapter 1. Beginning of verse 13, it says, therefore, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ as obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lust, as in your ignorance, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. There it is. This is what we're trying to become. To become holy, as he is. This, Peter here is referencing what we find in Leviticus 11, if you would like to jump back there, the instructions on the keeping of the food laws. Again, why do we do what we do? Why do we observe the food laws? It's not health. It is healthy for us, but that's not the reason. It's maybe part of the reason. No, I don't want to say it has no value in that regard at all, because it truly does. But what is the verses about it tell us? It tells us why. As we keep those physical things, it's teaching us something spiritual. Leviticus chapter 11, the end of the chapter, verse 44. So he goes through all these reasons and foods that we should eat, not eat. You know, this past few weeks, I was dealing with my health issues, and I had to eat nuts. They said nuts were good, so I went and bought some Planters roasted peanuts. I don't know if that was a good one or not, but that's what I like, so that's what I bought. It qualifies. So I got the big container, right? Halfway through the week, it's half gone. I don't know why. I picked up the box and read it, and I'm like, this is what I expected. Peanuts, salt, palm oil. That's kind of what I expected. Oh, no. There's a whole bunch of stuff, including gelatin. I'm like, what? I'm like, what? And peanuts. So it never ends, right? You always got to read ingredients, right? But why do we read ingredients? It tells us why, right? Because it's teaching us to discern, right, and look at what would defile us. And it says in verse 44, "For I am the Lord your God, you shall therefore consecrate yourselves, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth, for I am the Lord who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." It says something similar in Leviticus chapter 20, verse 25. Leviticus 20, verse 25, "You shall therefore distinguish between clean and unclean, between unclean birds and clean, and you shall not make yourselves abominable by beast or by bird or by any living thing that creeps on the ground which I have separated from you as unclean, and you shall be holy to me, for I, Lord, am holy and have separated you from the peoples that you should be mine." I think of these verses every time I'm in the grocery store reading labels. I don't know why I didn't read. Who has to read peanut labels? Well, apparently you do now. But every time that happens to me, I go right back to the lesson is always searching myself to take out that which defiles. And he's not talking about food, right? It could be whatever, our entertainment, whatever it is that misses the mark, doesn't help us zone in on hitting the mark. He says you got to get rid of that, and it'll be different for each one of us. But again, that's the lesson. Peter makes reference to this, and I always find it interesting that I think that's the lesson, and it still creeps in on us when we're not ready for it. Let's go back to 1 Peter. I want to go to chapter 2. Again, why do we do the things that we do, right? We are trying to become like Christ, like God. Everything short of that misses the mark. And again, it's not intended that we would find it so overwhelming that we quit. Because again, we know we can't be perfect in this life. What God, I think what he looks at in us is your heart and progress, right? Because we could all spend our whole life saying, excuses, right? We all heard the saying, excuses are like belly buttons. We all have them. They're all different, right? We could all make excuses for anything in our life. Well, it's because of this. It's because of that. It was, I had a bad upbringing. Whatever it is, we can all do that. But he says, no, I want you to put that aside and become like him. Stop with excuses. Zero in on that which will help you to hit the mark. 1 Peter chapter 2. Should have kept turning, sorry. Verse 1. "Therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and all evil speaking, as newborn babes, desiring the pure milk of the word, that you may grow thereby." This popped in my head. I can't tell you how many times, people will complain about a message, whether it's mine or somebody else's, and it's like, it's too much milk, we want meat, and then it's like, and then you ask, define that, if one person's milk is another person's meat, and one person's meat is somebody else's milk, right? But it says, "Desire the pure milk of the word, that you may grow thereby." So I usually tell a person, well, it's not bad to desire milk, so maybe you need to change your attitude a little bit. But they usually don't like it when I say that. "If indeed you have tasted that the Lord is gracious," verse 4, "coming to him as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." We're a household. We're a family. This is who God has called us together to be with. And he wants us to have that true koinonia, that fellowship, that relationship with each other, with him, with his son, right? And that should be what we're thinking about every time we have opportunity. How do I draw closer, right? Not forsaking the assembly. How do I stir up love and good works? All of that comes back to how do I strengthen koinonia, this fellowship relationship with each other and with Jesus Christ, right? We're being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood. Drop down to verse 9. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. You once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Verse 11 and verse 12. Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul, having your conduct honorable amongst the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. This is our why. This is what we're trying to become. Everything should be focused around, why am I doing what I'm doing? Am I being built up as a spiritual house? Am I qualifying to be part of a priestly, holy priesthood? This is a royal priesthood, a holy nation. And those parts of me that are not, those parts that miss the mark, then we go to work on those, right? And we continue to grow and change. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus makes a statement which at first glance seems a bit puzzling and maybe even impossible. Matthew chapter 5, and verse 17. He has spent a considerable amount of time correcting the scribes and Pharisees for being self-righteous hypocrites. And then he makes this statement, which sometimes puzzles people. Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till it is finished. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven, but whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Verse 20, this is the scripture. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. He wasn't telling us to be, Pharisees on steroids. That's not what he was saying. What he was saying was their, quote, righteousness was just an outward appearance. He said, yours needs to be beyond that. It needs to be of the heart. It needs to be sincere, no hypocrisy. It needs to be genuine. He says that's what it needs to go far beyond this outward appearance, right? And again, we can have outward appearance. We can show up and make everybody believe that we're whatever. God knows. But he says, no, your righteousness has to be well beyond that. Not just an outward appearance, right? Barnes notes, he says, the righteousness that Jesus required was purity, chastity, honesty, temperance, the fear of God, and the love of man. He goes on to write, it's pure, eternal, reaching the motives, the why, right? The motives, and making life holy. So when you put all this together, Jesus' promise to send the Holy Spirit as a helper becomes all the more clear to us. When you think about all what we've just gone through, why are we here? Why do we do the things that we do? John 14. It helps us to fully understand what it is we are striving to achieve in this life. It's why we go to church. It's why we keep the feasts. It's why we follow God's commandments. It's why we do the things that we do. John 14. And we'll begin in verse 15. John 14, 15, Jesus says, if you love me, keep my commandments, and I will pray the Father, and he will give you another helper, that it may abide with you forever. The Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees it nor knows it, but you know it, for it dwells with you and will be in you. I will not leave you orphans. I will come to you. Verse 19, a little while longer, and the world will see me no more, but you will see me because I live. You will live also. At that day, you will know. Now listen to what he says here, and think about koinonia, that fellowship. And in that day, you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. It's that relationship, that fellowship, right? He who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me, and he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him. It all fits together. As you and I keep his commandments, right, as we live our lives obedient to him, we do it with a pure heart out of genuine love for God, and we have fellowship, koinonia with him, Christ, and each other, showing love towards one another, the fulfillment of those two commandments. You and I come closer and closer to hitting the mark as we keep that in mind. We'll never be perfect, but it's something we should be striving towards. We've been called out of this world into a relationship with God and each other. It doesn't please God when we just pop in and pop out. He wants, if we can't get along in this life, I keep asking myself this question. You know, if you can't get along with somebody in this life, well, God, is God going to put up with your disagreements for eternity? My answer is no. So one of us isn't going to be there. You know, and I could sit here and say, well, it's probably going to be that person. I would be better off to just get reconciled if there's a matter, right? I mean, that's because he's not going to deal with squabbling kids for eternity. It's not going to happen. This is where we work it out. In this life is where we work it all out. And we won't do it perfectly, and God's grace and his mercy can clothe us in that regard when we don't do it quite perfectly. But John 17, and a couple of scriptures and we'll wrap up. John 17, in his prayer to the Father before he was betrayed, here again, notice the words of Jesus Christ, John 17, beginning verse 20. He says, I do not pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word, that they all may be one, as you, Father, are in me. Now, keep in mind, again, we're going to read these at Passover, and you're probably all going to read them before we get to Passover, right? That they all may be one, verse 21, as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be one in us. Koinonia, that relationship that involves all of us and God and Christ. That the world may believe that you sent me, verse 22, and the glory which you gave me, I have given them, that they may be one just as we are one. Verse 23, I in them, and you in me, that they may be perfect in one, and that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them as you have loved me. You know, this relationship that we're supposed to have, right, involves God and Christ. So we can't, it involves everybody. And so it's important that we understand that we have this responsibility as we look at these verses and we approach Passover and the Holy Days, we should be reminded of our responsibility then to examine myself, right? Just examine self. Am I closer to hitting the mark? And those things that continue to miss the mark, go to work on those things. But am I closer than I was last year? Like, it's not about being perfect. It's about, am I growing? And we should consider then if there's something between you and a brother, a partner in the koinonia, the fellowship that we're supposed to have, that's part of our entire life. Is there a matter that needs to be resolved? And if there is, then be reconciled. Go and be reconciled, as it says, and then bring your altar. So I ask the question again, why do we do the things that we do? I'm going to end in Ephesians 5. Paul writes to the church in Ephesus, and he's describing the husband and wife relationship, but he hits upon a statement in Ephesians chapter 5 that speaks to us in terms of what it is he's trying to accomplish in our lives, what we should think about as we consider, why do I do the things that I do? Why am I here every Sabbath? Why do I keep the holy days? Why do I follow the food laws? Why do I do the things that God commands me to do? Why am I doing that? Is it transactional, quid pro quo? I do this, God blesses me. Well, if that's your attitude, then the minute you don't feel blessed, you begin to want to renege on the deal. Right? But that's not what God's doing. We see here in Ephesians 5, all of this, as we understand why we're doing this, he says in verse 25, husbands, love your wife. Now notice what he says. Just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of the water by the word, that he might present her to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish.